Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The Kunstlercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. I hope you all had a happy new year and that you're sticking to your resolutions. I have a few resolutions of my own. First and foremost, I am going to get through a very impressive pile of listener calls and comments. My apologies to anyone who's been waiting to hear your call. It is coming soon. And along those lines, now that I know how to use the phone recorder, I will be having some more guests join Jim and me on the show like I promised last year and did not deliver. That is coming soon. On next week's show, we'll be talking about Jim's forecast for 2011, and we'll look back at his 2010 forecast. Today's show is all about writing. It's about Jim's literary influences. It's about what the role of a social critic is and how you balance your persona as a social critic with your actual person. And I did ask Jim to maybe think about what he might want his legacy to be, how he wants to be remembered. That is all for, it's kind of background research for the introduction to a book I'm writing based on the first 3 years of the Kunstlercast. I'll be telling you more about that later. It is not going to be available until August or thereabouts. But if you're listening now and you think you might be interested in that book and you might want a reminder, please sign up for the Kunstlercast mailing list. The link is on the Kunstlercast.com website in the right-hand column, and I'll put the sign-up link in the show notes for today's program as well. I only send about two or three emails to that list a year. So, Jim, your nonfiction work is better known than your fiction.
Yeah, I guess it is. Sure. Yeah.
Like, you're better known as a journalist, commentator, than as a novelist.
And the publishers will tell you, you know, that nonfiction just sells better than fiction does. You know, people...
Right.
Fewer people read novels nowadays. It's just the way it is. It's not the 19th century anymore.
But do you sometimes begrudge that you have to write the nonfiction? I mean, would you rather simply be writing, you know, creating art, essentially?
Well, yeah. Basically, I would rather be writing fiction. Yeah, I would rather be writing the next two installments of World Made by Hand, which I fully intend to get to.
Yeah.
However, I just like composing prose, and I like doing it in nonfiction as well as fiction, and I get a bang out of it, and you know, I'm very fortunate that I can choose my own subject matter. And I think what a lot of people maybe don't quite get about me is that my writing is much more about prose artistry than it is about, you know, dredging up facts about the petroleum industry or, you know, politics or resource issues. I'm much more interested in exercising my skills, and especially my malicious sense of humor, which is important to me. You know, comedy is important to me, and my books are as much about comedy as they are about, you know, the subject matter. The Long Emergency, as kind of dire as it was really very consciously crafted to be full of gags. Because, you know, as I said in one of my earlier books, it's the unfortunate fate of the ridiculous to be ridiculed. And, you know, we have become kind of a ridiculous nation lurching around through an impossible situation. And, you know, it's close to something like a Laurel and Hardy movie or, you know, Charlie Chaplin. It's, you know, we're literally becoming kind of a slapstick clown nation, if we weren't before. I may, you know, perhaps we were just as bad in 1932. I don't know.
Well, you've mentioned before H.L. Mencken, and
yeah.
He was a writer, you know, performing a similar role that you are today,
yeah.
By commenting on the ridiculousness of America at the time. And, you know, you have NASCAR morons, and he had Bubis Americanus.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so.
Well, I was influenced by Mencken when I was a kid, and I do remember the first book of his that I just stumbled on, and it was the summer of 1967. I was working in the college summer theater, which was an amphitheater outdoors, They put us up in this sort of auxiliary nature reserve campus that was 9 miles away from the main campus, and we were pretty isolated. And one day I caught a ride into town, and I went to the college bookstore just to get some books. You know, there was no internet back then, and, you know, there were only like 2 TV stations out of Niagara Falls that you could barely get, and nobody had a TV anyway. So I went in to get some books, and I stumbled across this collection of Mencken's essays. Mencken was a journalist who is now almost completely forgotten, whose heyday was the years from about 1910 to about 1945 or so, when he really kind of faded away. And he was especially popular during the 1920s, which was a wild era of excess in the USA, and it was a great kind of circus for him to observe. And one of the greatest acts in the many rings of the American circus back then was the Scopes trial, which he famously covered. That was the so-called monkey trial in Tennessee, where they tried to convict a biology teacher for teaching evolution. Mencken went down there and savagely covered the proceedings, and the prosecuting attorney recruited by the county or the town to prosecute this biology teacher named John Scopes was a former 3-time presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan, who had run as a Democrat at the turn of the century and lost 3 times. And by the time the Scopes trial came along in 1925, he was kind of a religious nut, or probably was one all along. He had gotten a lot older, and he was kind of old and sick and seedy, and his hair was falling out in patches, and he kind of looked weird and dressed in weird Midwestern antique costumes that were kind of laughable to big city people. So Mencken took great delight in mocking him and ridiculing him during this whole ordeal of the Scopes trial, which took about a month, I think, several weeks, and journalists from all over the country traveled to Little Dayton, Tennessee, and it was the summer, and it was really hot, and it was hot in the courtroom, and they were all suffering. And at night, Mencken would steal away from town and drive out into the countryside and go to these religious revival meetings that were happening out in the bush, and the backwoods of Tennessee, before the Second World War, were still pretty primitive. The roads were bad. There was no suburbia back then. You know, the people were pretty, they were real country people, a real kind of Appalachian country people, and they were holding these, you know, religious revivals and snake handling sessions and speaking in the tongues and rolling around on the ground. So Mencken reported on all this and made it the butt of humor. And then the cherry on top of the whole thing was that poor William Jennings Bryan died of a cerebral hemorrhage like 2 days after the Scopes trial ended. Mencken wrote a vicious obituary of Bryan after that happened. It was, you know, one of the more vicious things that was ever published in American journalism, but also very funny. And that was pretty much his high spot. You know, he had a malicious sense of humor too, Mencken did. And the 20s came and went, and the Great Depression started. And Mencken, at least the standard view of Mencken, is that he wasn't really able to adjust his views to the realities of the Depression and the hardship that people were suffering, and that his humor really wasn't going over very well as that went on. He was also considered to be a fairly pro-German because he was very proud of his German ancestry, and he had carried on quite a bit during the First World War about the acts that were being legislated against German Americans at that time, in the period 1917, 1918. And so when the Second World War rolled around, he was considered to be kind of, you know, an unappetizingly pro-German character. And, you know, the public sentiment really sort of started going against him, and he sort of faded away. And then in 1948, he had a massive stroke, another just as, you know, William Jennings Bryan had, only it didn't kill him, it just disabled him. And one of the great ironies of life, you know, it affected his ability to read and write. and, you know, not that much else. So he could no longer do what he was so good at doing. And he lived on another 7 years, and then, you know, totally faded away in 1956 or 7 or something like that, passed away, unnoticed in Baltimore. His home today, it's still maintained by some society, but it's in a very slummy, what has now become a very slummy neighborhood of Baltimore. He was renowned for being, you know, a Baltimorean who refused to move to New York. He ran a couple of magazines in New York during the 1920s, but he took the train up there every week and then came back home to Baltimore. So that's the story of Mencken.
So you discovered Mencken as a college student, and that
well, it was really a galvanizing moment. You know, being 18 years old and being exposed to that extremely muscular comic prose. I mean, he really had it down, and he really had a style that was his. And I have very consciously done everything I can to not copy the way he expressed himself. And, you know, about the only thing that I really do is that I use M dashes, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I'm trying to avoid anything that, you know, smacks of him.
Are there any other critics out there or writers who influenced your style?
Yeah, I had a similar kind of galvanizing moment when Tom Wolfe exploded on the pages of the Herald Tribune Sunday Supplement back in about 1963. And, you know, I was just getting to that point of being a young adult. You know, I was 14, 15 years old and reading a lot and growing up in New York City, you know, and exposed to a lot of high and low culture of exactly the kind that he was covering. So I was familiar with some of it. And Tom Wolfe exploded on the pages of what later evolved into New York Magazine, but which at the time was just the Herald Tribune's somewhat lame attempt to compete with the New York Times Magazine. But actually, it got real good real quick, although the Herald Tribune eventually bit the dust, a great newspaper of the mid-20th century, now gone. But Tom Wolfe came out, and, you know, his prose was just spectacular. You know, he was really able to put it across, and he was able to put it across funny and also make a point. And so, you know, what I began to, and that was before I had encountered Mencken by maybe, 3-4 years. So, you know, what I discovered with these two guys, Mencken and Tom Wolfe, was that being a comic writer was what I wanted to do. And I don't mean a comic book.
Right.
You know, I wanted to write comic discursive prose about things, about issues that were, you know, important and interesting. It was a little bit hard for me to get to sort out the issues, you know, in a way that, I mean, I wasn't sitting down and writing essays about American culture. I spent my college years actually being a theater major, so you know, I got kind of sidetracked from my interest in literature. Although it ended up helping a lot, because you know, one of the big influences on me was Samuel Beckett, and I did Beckett plays when I was in college. Beckett was an Irish playwright who ended his days with the 20th century, pretty much. You know, I don't know how much people pay attention to him now, but he was very prominent and popular in the late 60s. And his greatest play, perhaps, or best-known play, being Waiting for Godot, which people make reference to still. I was in that play, and I toured in it quite a bit. We got some kind of a grant from the state of New York to take it all over. So I was on the road with this play, you know, living like a vaudevillian at the age of 19. And Waiting for Godot is about two tramps, you know, who are in some nameless French countryside wilderness waiting for some guy who says he's going to show up but never does. And the whole show is about what they do when they're waiting. And, you know, it's an absurdist 1960s kind of abstract piece, but it's full of wonderfully written dialogue and truly beautifully composed images. And Beckett was just a wonderfully lyric writer. And so one of the things that taught me was that it was possible to incorporate lyricism with comic writing. And I became very interested in that. So by the time I graduated from college and I just sort of dumped my theater career and decided really not to go on with it and got into the newspaper game, you know, I was very interested in writing stuff that was comical and lyrical about things that mattered. The one thing that I had to catch up with was understanding really what mattered in my society, because I was immature and naive, and you just don't know a whole lot when you're 23 years old. Probably the galvanizing event for me was when I covered the OPEC oil embargo in 1973, and I realized, oh yeah, this is important, how we live in America and what it's going to mean for, you know, how we get to where we're going in the future in America. And, you know, now I've seen a little glimpse of the future now, and I wonder what's going to be happening. And is this maybe the big story? I got sidetracked from that for 10 years, and, that all faded away during the Ronald Reagan era and a bit beyond into the Clinton years. And so, you know, there I was writing novels. You know, I wasn't writing about this big story, but, you know, there were bits of it were getting into my books. But the whole experience of hanging in there and writing one book after another that no one has asked to be written, you know, was itself a very fortifying exercise, because I spent really a lot of time practicing how to write, learning how to compose sentences and paragraphs and do it artistically. I also learned something else that was really important. I learned how to work in a vacuum. And it was one of the probably the benefits of being generally unsuccessful for a long period of time, that you learn how to keep on going, doing what you're doing without a whole lot of validation. You know, it is validating to get a book contract the first few times. But by the time you've got your sixth or seventh book contract and you sort of know how things work, you know that you're going to publish a book and there's an excellent chance that no one will pay attention to it and that no one will notice it. And, you know, so that kind of fortifies you, and you learn how to operate in this vacuum where you're doing what you do because you were rewarded by the act of doing it. You know, I was rewarded by the simple act of composing the stuff I was composing. And finishing the job. And, you know, just going through the exercise of getting a book into publication, whether it's going to be successful or not, you know, that's, it ends up professionalizing you. So I got to this point in my career where, you know, I learned not to give manuscripts to my friends and loved ones. I learned to not expect other people to read my shit and tell me how wonderful it was. In that, I was not disappointed, because the newspaper reviewers behaved exactly the same way. They, you know, they didn't tell me anything one way or another either. But, you know, the books got published, and, you know, the odd thing to me is that moment in my life when I really set out on a different pathway for the second time in my adult life. The first time was when I dropped out of journalism. The second time was when I returned to journalism. You know, at the age of about 40. And all of a sudden, you know, I was a mature person who had done a lot of things. One thing was I had been sitting in upstate New York, sort of semi-starving to death, practicing how to write for 10 years and doing a lot of practice. And in the meantime, I had learned a few things about how the world worked that I didn't know when I was 25, you know. So I was more capable of tackling important issues. So I was well prepared for that, but it was kind of an ordeal. There's another important thing that I took from that experience of basically failing for 10 years, you know, even though I got books published, they were unsuccessful. But what I learned was that perseverance is much more important than talent. That, you know, it, you just got to stay in the game. It didn't really matter to anybody that my paragraphs were nicely polished, or that my, you know, that I had some nice dialogue in my novels, or that, you know, some of them were better than others, obviously, but that some of them were pretty good, even if they didn't sell very well. I shuffled around a lot of things that were, you know, works in progress that for one reason weren't working. And some people just can't do that. They can't drop something that it's like their baby, you know, it's like they can't put their baby in cold storage and go on and, you know, make another baby. What I took from that was, you know, you gotta endure. Talent is important, and you really have to cultivate it, and you really have to practice. But ultimately, the most important thing is going to be whether you can persevere.
Jim, talk to me about being both a prose artist and a critic, because you are serving in both roles, right?
And well, I stopped reviewing books a long time ago because, you know, apart from the fact that you can make a little money writing reviews, and an awful lot of people did used to do that, you know, it mostly makes you enemies. And that's not a good thing, because and it's happened to me a couple of times. And so I ventured into the book reviewing world, and wrote. I learned that, you know, you just can't write bad reviews for people that who know you. It's just not a good thing to do. It's bad. So, you know, and I didn't want to write just good reviews of shit, you know, especially if I didn't believe it. And unless you get to a certain level, you know, you can't necessarily pick the books you're going to review. Basically, some editor sends you a book and says, review this, and you're stuck with it. And so I got out of the book reviewing business, and I became a different kind of a critic. You know, I became, you know, a kind of a social critic in the mold of what Mencken had been doing in the 20s, but, you know, living in a very, very different world. But the role of social commentator or social critic is an old and honorable role that, you know, any number of people can occupy in a certain period of history. And today we have people, you know, like Tom Wolfe is still around, and Chris Hedges, and Daniel Quinn, and Alan Bloom, Henry Louis Gates. Marshall Berman was with us for a while. I think he's gone, actually, now. But, you know, these people who have something to say about the society that they're living in, and where it's going and what it's doing. It's, you know, it's changing now because of the internet. And all the old gatekeepers who were there, and the journals and the magazines up until about 1999, you know, a lot of those places and people and venues are gone. And, you know, we're now kind of stuck with the internet, which is like a great carnival of cranks and, you know, mixed up with legitimate voices. And it becomes a little bit hard to sort out who's who. But, you know, what I've noticed in my own reading on the internet is that you do sort out the cranks and the jokers and the clowns from the people who actually have something to say. And I think that sorting process is underway. You know, the difference is that, you know, you have to do it yourself. It's no longer done for you by, let's say, the editor of the New York Times Magazine or roles like that. And there were many, many gatekeepers for published thought. So I think people are learning how to do it themselves now. Although I've never been convinced that the internet was going to be as permanent a part of the intellectual landscape as printed stuff was. You know, I think the internet's going to probably have a pretty short run, because look, and you know, I'm sorry, it's my own quirky belief, and you know, I may be wrong, but to me, the whole question of the internet is intimately connected with our ability to keep the electric grid running really reliably. Not just running now and again, or, you know, running 12 hours a day or when it feels like it, but running the way we're used to it, which is it's never off. And, you know, you can walk into a room and throw a switch and be fairly confident the lights are going to come on. Most of us are completely unconscious of doing that. You know, in fact, I dare say that if the time ever came where we were conscious of walking into a room and throwing the lights and wondering whether the lights were going to go on, that would be a signal to us that we were, You know, things had changed really direly. But we're not there yet. What's normal now under today's circumstances, a lot of people think is going to continue forever. And I'm just a little bit skeptical about that. I'm a lot skeptical about it. And I'm not sure that this medium, as intricately amazing as it is going to continue. And also, you know, we are suffering from the diminishing returns of the internet. And I'm not sure what the net gain for us it really is. You know, if nothing else, the internet is stealing so much of our time every day that people like me have less and less time to compose thoughtful commentary. And I'm not sure that we weren't better off in the days when we were writing a first draft on a legal pad and then typing it.
Do you separate your critic persona from your own persona? I don't know, the persona, the person you are when you're not, you know, wearing your critic's hat. You know, Jim Kunstler, the guy who lives in Saratoga, who
shops
at the grocery store. You know?
I do. I think actually, you know, this, I don't know whether it's psychologically healthy or not, but my persona does feel pretty compartmentalized.
Yeah.
Although it's not difficult for me to go in and out of the different personas that I'm familiar with. The guy who goes downtown to the supermarket or meets his friends on the street is very different from the guy who sits in front of the video display, you know, pushing pixels around with a mouse and making sentences and thinking about, you know, what's going on politically and economically in the country.
Yeah.
Largely, this has to do with the fact that my personality is largely, you know, that of a comedian. When all is said and done, you know, I'd rather be funny and I'd rather, you know, crack jokes than be serious. So, you know, it takes an effort for me to be serious, and my way of being serious often involves me trying to be funny.
Okay, so you compartmentalize the different personas of James Howard Kunstler, but obviously the people who know you and through that persona, maybe they're disappointed or they're even looking to attack you, let's say, if they see you
driving my pickup truck.
Driving your pickup truck, flying around.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So how do you deal with that? How do you react to the criticisms of the critic?
I've been a kind of a quasi-public figure for, I mean, I'm not like a celebrity, but I'm kind of a low-rent kind of public figure who has, I have a public profile. You know, I put stuff out there. I put myself out there.
You put stuff out there that pokes people, too. It hits certain nerves of people, so they're paying attention to you. They want to see,
yeah,
you know, where does this guy live? What does this guy drive?
Well,
what does he eat?
Yeah, and I think that the public is almost always disappointed when they run into a public figure of some kind, you know, whether it's Brad Pitt or me. You know, they're always disappointed to discover that, you know, you're wearing a certain kind of sneaker, or that you're driving a pickup truck, or that, you know, you're flying 3,000 miles to Seattle or something like that, you know.
Do you feel any obligation to live up to the expectations of Kunstler the critic?
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's a good question. I feel an obligation to be a decent human being. I feel an obligation to pay attention to people who are asking for it under reasonable terms. You know, if a stranger comes up to me, wants to talk to me at some public event, I do try to pay attention. I don't try to blow them off. I answer all of my email, you know, even from cranks, even if it's only a two-sentence response. So,
or two words, fuck you.
I very rarely say that. Very rarely.
Yeah.
Usually only when someone, you know, writes to me calling me, you know, a Jew bastard, faggot, moron or something, you know.
It doesn't. I've had people send me emails in the past. I've tried to respond tersely, not with necessarily fuck you, but I've tried to just kind of be dismissive and terse. It never works. They're just going to keep sending you emails and you're going to keep getting
I actually have discovered the way to deal with those people is to kill them with kindness. is to just, you know,
validate them.
Not even validate them, just, you know, write back and just say, well, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, and I see it differently, and
right.
And who knows, you know, maybe I'm wrong and you're right. And,
yeah.
And I try to disarm them, but once in a while, you know, I am in a bad mood, or they catch me in the wrong time, and, you know, and I'll say something mean back.
So what do you say when someone finds you at the strip mall in suburbia buying a bag of cheese doodles and then hopping in your car?
I don't feel hypersensitive about it. I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea that, you know, I'm a creature of my time and place. We all do tend to be hostages to our time and our place and the manner and modes of our time and place. So,
yeah,
I'm not embarrassed about that at all. I bought a bag of cheese doodles last night to go to a little cocktail reception for a friend who was starting a new job at a wildlife center up the road, you know? And I just felt like, you know, it's never a party unless the cheese doodles are there, so... I got me a bag and brought them. And you know what? I ate a few of them. Hardly anyone else would touch them because they seem to be radioactive, but I had a few.
Somebody at your... Every year I go to your holiday party.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's usually a bowl of cheese doodles or something like that. But this recent one, you had a bowl of cheese doodles.
I always have them.
Oh, okay.
You just don't really sniff them out. They're there.
But people are standing around thinking that, you know, like, oh, he's being ironic. And I was thinking, I think he's just putting out a bowl of cheese doodles. I don't know if you're deliberately being ironic, are you?
No, I don't even like the kind of ironic stance that has been so popular in my generation for such a long time. Because, you know, my view of the whole thing is that you can't really develop that overall ironic stance about life unless everything about your life is fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and there is a lot about American life that's ridiculous, but like I refuse to submit to being a victim of the ridiculousness of it. So I'm not going to just stand by and say, "Oh, you know, isn't all our ridiculous shit cute?" It's like, you know, why I'm not into kitsch.
Right.
You know, I'm not into kitsch because I believe that if something was really stupid and shitty the first time, you shouldn't bring it back and celebrate it, you know, for its stupid shittiness. So I don't do that. And it doesn't do anything for me.
So Jim, I think some people can't help it when they hear your criticisms of, you know, American society or suburbia or whatever. I think some people can't help but feeling defensive when they hear those things. And my question is, how has being a social critic commenting on these issues, how has it affected your personal relations? I mean, you know, do you find your friends are getting upset with you sometimes for the things that you're saying about America? Or,
no,
or do you keep it separate?
You know, at most, my really close friends where I live, you know, they all have very little connection with my writing life. You know, they're not necessarily people who are reading everything I write. They're people who think that my long emergency ideas are crazy.
So they don't necessarily share your...
Some of them think that, you know, some of them think that I'm nuts thinking that there's some kind of a problem out there with America. Now, I don't necessarily hang out with the kind of suburban people that you'd find in, let's say, you know, one of these boom cities of the last 50 years. You know, I don't live in Dallas or Orlando or Phoenix. And, you know, if I lived in a place like that, I'd encounter probably people who are maybe more defensive and angry about a point of view that opposes what they've invested in.
Yeah.
But I'm not. And the places that really fascinate me are the places where there's a collision between something closer to my sensibility and something that's that alien, you know, middle American, conservative, NASCAR suburban mentality. I see it, you know, most vividly in a place like Boulder, Colorado, you know, where they're surrounded by these seas of tract houses and foreclosure estates and, you know, just tremendous suburban sprawl clusterfuck of all the worst kind of crap that I've ever imagined. And in their own town, they've built a town that's about 93% suburban crapola. And yet, you know, they're at the very core of this town are, yuppie boomer progressives. You know, now that I actually sit down and think about it, I know very few people who live in anything, you know, that I would remotely call standard issue suburbia. You know, I do live in a Main Street town that's still pretty much a mainstream town. But, you know, I have very few friends who are violently defending anything that I'm yapping about.
About suburbia, but they think the long emergency energy issues are a little wacky.
Well, they're not necessarily paying attention. They don't, you know, they're not familiar with Jeff Brown's export land theory. That, you know, they don't look at the EIA figures. You know, they're not paying attention to the oildrum.com. They're just really just going about their lives, and the supermarket's still full of stuff.
Yeah.
And despite all of the disarray in the financial sector, you know, they're still getting paid, and they're still, you know, I don't know that many people who have been tossed out of their job, although I met one person last night at this party I went to who I've known for 35 years who is out of work and, you know, probably will at some point maybe get a little desperate. Maybe is now.
Okay, Jim, I got one more question for you. Have you ever thought about your legacy that you're going to leave behind? Do you ever think about how you want to be remembered? Or do you ever think about what you want your contribution to be?
Well, I don't know if I've ever thought about it in those terms exactly, but what I have thought about is this, that the way I really think about anything remotely like that is that I'm comfortable with what I've accomplished in my life. You know, I can look at a shelf of books and say, I wrote a shelf of books. And so I know that I didn't go through this world uselessly for the time that I took up. I'm fairly comfortable with, you know, who I turned out to be as an adult human being. I actually did learn how to take care of myself after a pretty bad start in adulthood, you know, pretty floundering start, not being able to even, like, pay the light bill. I finally figured that out. I think I could have, my matrimonial record's a bit sketchy and not something I'm really proud of, and I apologize to all my ex-wives and, and even some girlfriends. I didn't have any children. It just worked out that way, despite the fact that I was married and perform the procreative act more than a few times. And probably the only thing I'm really kind of sorry about is I didn't dress better. You know, I work at home, so I can just put any old thing on and just go to my office. And I wouldn't want to go the Tom Wolfe route, you know, and my fantasy about old Tom. Well, I only met once in an elevator in my whole life. But my fantasy about old Tom is, you know, he's living in some kind of an East Side townhouse, and he gets up every morning and puts on a white suit and goes to a beautifully appointed office with a Louis Couture's antique desk that probably cost $104,000 with inlaid, all kinds of inlaid marquetry. And he's there in his white suit with a handkerchief in his white suit pocket and some kind of a beautiful Hermes tie, you know, and he looks great. And then he rolls out of the house and goes out to lunch at a place where people see him in his white suit and they say, oh, he's wearing a white suit. He looks very nice. I'm kind of sorry that I don't do that, you know, that I'm just wearing my old Polar Tech velour zip up full of cat hair. So I apologize to you, Duncan, because I could have put on better clothes for you. Maybe next year, my New Year's resolution will be, I'm going to put on a tie for Duncan when he comes over to do the podcast, or if I go down to his crib in Troy to do it there.
I'm in the same boat, Jim. I'm a little disappointed with my wardrobe. I had nice clothes, but I've worn them to threadbare at this point.
I got an idea. Let's go shopping. What do you say?
Yeah, well, after the next check comes in, maybe we will.
But listen, dude, you know, I think that the sales after Christmas this year are going to be like nothing we've ever seen before in our lifetimes, man. You know, Joseph A. Bank is going to be giving away suits for like 29 cents for three of them.
I'm there, man.
Just to move the merch off the shelves.
Yeah, I'm there.
What do you think you're going to get into? Like foulard ties and
Jim, I got to buy like
shirts and
I've got to buy like 12 pairs of shoes. I mean, I have holes in my shoes. I have holes in the crotches of every.
What are you, a fucking hobo?
I've just worn everything out, so I think I'll be there with you.
Okay.
For the after
you want
Christmas
some shoes
sale.
For Christmas? What's your size?
9.5D.
Okay, I'll see what I can rustle up for you.
All right, well, Jim, thanks for yakking with me today, and we'll catch up soon.
It's been a pleasure, and hey, if I don't see you before Christmas, man, I hope that St. Nick brings you some shoes.
Yeah, and puts some gold coins in those shoes.
That would be nice, too.
All right, thanks.
You want penny loafers with like half, you know, half ounce gold pieces in the tongue there?
Sure. Beggars can't be choosers.
All right. We'll see if we can make that happen.
You've been listening to The Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.